Welcome to the Finance and Governance Committee of Denver City Council. This meeting of the Finance and Governance Committee begins now.
Hey, good morning, everyone. It is Tuesday, June 24th, 10:40 a.m. Sorry, we're starting a couple of minutes late with our Finance and Governance Committee today. I'm Amanda Sawyer. I have the honor of representing the residents of District 5 and chairing this committee. We have a couple of action items today, so let's go ahead and get started. But first, we'll do a round of council member introductions, and I am going to start on my left.
Good morning, everyone. Serena Gonzalez-Gutierrez, one of your council members at large.
Good morning, Darrell Watson, Fine District 9.
Good morning, Diana Romero-Campbell, Southeast Denver, District 4.
Good morning, Paul Cashman, South Denver, District 6.
Good morning, excuse me? Yeah. Wait, good morning, Amanda Sandoval, Northwest Denver, District 1.
Good morning, Stacey Gilmore, District 11.
Morning, I'll leave out the good. Kevin Flynn, Southwest Denver, District 2.
World in turmoil.
Chantel Lewis, District 8.
All right, we've got two action items today. The first one is going to go in a block. It's 9:14 and 9:15. The DDDA Plan of Development Loan and Special Revenue Fund. So if you guys want to introduce yourselves and then take it away, that would be great.
Great. Good morning. I'm Donna Wilder with the Department of Finance.
And I'm Hannah Stewart, also with the Department of Finance.
Thanks so much for having us this morning. We are here to provide an update on the Denver Downtown Development Authority Investment Program. As you all know, since beginning this implementation of this program nearly a year ago back in April, we've had a lot of activity to get us ready for major catalytic investments in our downtown area. And so the purpose of today is to provide a brief overview and update of where we're at. And then we have two council action requests. 0914, this is going to prepare funds to help us implement our investment program. And then the second one, 0915, is to request to create a new city fund for operations, and this will help us with our staffing and legal expenses for the program. We've had six rounds of council briefings since the start of this program, so thank you all for your patience and contributions to this program. We couldn't have got here without all of you. And the reason why we're here today is really due to the successful election back in November, where qualified electors with over 77% approval authorized a debt issuance of up to $570 million without raising taxes to help us implement this program. So following that voter authorization in November, we've held two large informational sessions to provide information to the community and the market on how they can submit applications to request funding. Since that time, our application portal has opened, and we have started to receive applications and began those initial evaluations for those projects. To date, we've received 44 applications and a total request of nearly $450 million. So we are rapidly getting those requests in for consideration. The two council actions today that we'll talk through are not tied to any particular project, but we do need to have the funds available prior to obligating them and awarding those funds to projects. So we look forward to bringing those projects. Yes.
Do you have a presentation that is...
It's not moving forward. You have to move it forward yourself. So I wasn't sure if this is all just introduction.
It is an introduction.
Okay, great.
Thank you. Yes.
Just wanted to make sure for people watching at home who are only seeing a screen that's not moving forward, I wanted to clarify. Thank you.
Thank you. Yep, we'll get rolling through to the next slide here. Which is our agenda. So we're going to talk through just a little bit about what the DDDA is for anybody listening in who this may be new to. Our investment area, the plan of development that guides the work that's undertaken by the Development Authority, the evaluation criteria that you all have helped us develop and how we're going to be scoring projects. And then I'm going to hand it over to Hannah to talk through the two specific council action requests, those terms and conditions, and our timeline. All right, so a little bit about how the Development Authority works. This is a quasi-public entity. It's separate from the city, but the city does manage the operations of the authority. It was authorized by the City and County of Denver and formed via an election. It uses tax increment finance, otherwise known as TIF, both sales and property taxes. It is not a new tax. It just uses the existing mills that are levied upon the properties within the boundaries of the district. Generally, what happens is when property is added to the district, there is a base assessed value set. And when an improvement is made upon that property, the value increases. The difference between the base value and the increase in value because of that improvement is the TIF. What this program is aimed at is looking for projects that regenerate that TIF. Meaning not only will we get the projects that we need for our economic recovery now, but if they regenerate TIF into the future, it preserves the tool for future generations to help them with their economic recoveries as well. We do have a plan of development area. The statute requires that the authority operate within the Central Business District. Additional property can be added. We're going to talk through that when we look at our investment map. The current board has a five director board seats. Four of those seats are appointed by the mayor and confirmed by city council. The fifth is the automatic council president that serves as a board of director. Now, the scope undertaken by the authority is guided by a plan of development. We're going to talk through that here in just a moment. Now, our development authority was created in 2008. There is a 30-year initial statutory term, so it is scheduled to expire in 2038. Thereafter, the statute allows for 20-year term extensions into perpetuity. The original boundary was Denver Union Station and Market Station. Now, the reason why we have this tool is because Denver Union Station has performed exceedingly well. The revenues that are being generated from that project are far greater than the debt service that's due on the loan. So that excess revenue can be invested into new projects. That original investment back in 2009 was approximately $400 million. In 2019, there was an economic study performed that estimated that the economic output was nearly $2.3 billion. So we've seen quite a bit of a return on investment from that project. And as we noted before, in November 2024, voters authorized up to $570 million to invest into new projects without raising taxes, that with over 77% approval. Now, the purpose of the DDA is to support catalytic investments that spur and accelerate economic growth and revitalization and deliver a family-friendly, thriving, and diversified downtown. We do have a really great website. We've updated this with a ton of information, including an interactive map. Folks can go to this map, submit their property address, and it will indicate to them whether their property is eligible for inclusion into the district. Inclusion into the district is voluntary. The statute requires that any property to be added must be adjacent to the current boundary, which is illustrated in blue on this map, and it must be owned in fee. All property owners must petition for inclusion and provide evidence of that ownership. This does require approval by both the DDDA board as well as city council. So highly encourage you to take a look at that map. The next slide here is our plan of development. Now the plan of development really broadened the scope of the categories or projects that can be undertaken by the development authority. This was adopted by city council on December 9th of last year. So thank you all so much for your help approving this and allowing us to implement this plan of development. This really expanded the scope, but did not identify specific projects, rather categories for investment that could address economic challenges and promote growth within the district. All projects that receive funding must be in alignment with this plan of development. And those categories are new development and adaptive reuse. So looking at things like office to resi conversions, parks and public spaces, connectivity and mobility, so looking at the circulation of our grid downtown, livability, economic opportunity, and jobs. Livability really speaks to projects that fill gaps in services within the community. Arts, culture, and activation, that really looks towards large art infrastructure, installations, art murals, and the equipment needed to support large events to really drive foot traffic downtown. Last slide for me before I hand it over is our evaluation criteria. Now, this was formed in collaboration with City Council, with community stakeholders, and the DDDA board. And what resulted is five major categories on how we're going to score projects. The first one is financials. So looking at the pro formas, making sure that project's capital stack is reliable, that they have the funds ready to start their project. We're going to be looking at contingencies, so making sure that they have a financial buffer in case costs of labor or materials increase. We're going to be looking at the requested amount of funding, and then the post-value. Post-value is after they deliver their project, an estimate of what that increased property value is. This helps us estimate the potential TIF regeneration back into the district. Feasibility, looking at start and finish dates. So as we all know, there's only 13 years left remaining within the initial term of the DDA. So making sure that those projects are ready to start, to get delivered to the community and start regenerating that tax increment. Risks and mitigation strategies looks at if there's any potential for discovery of contamination on the site. We want to make sure that they have a plan to mitigate that in case that happens. Readiness, looking at the status of the project, whether they're in conceptual phase, maybe some design, or if they're ready to pull permits. Again, this tells us how ready they are to get the project started. Policy, again, looking at livability, if they're filling a gap in services. Sustainability features is whether they're incorporating solar panels, passive heating and cooling, energy efficient appliances, those sorts of things. Economic impacts, both on a regional and local level. We work with our chief economist to estimate these impacts. And then the equity and accessibility. So looking at who comprises their development team, their construction team, and the demographics that are being served within the community. Accessibility speaks to if they're going above and beyond ADA requirements, adding wider doorways, additional ramps. And then activation and impacts, the last one here is looking at the job creations, at foot traffic, which really speaks to the potential generation of tax increment. Longevity and magnitude, so looking at how long the project will impact the community, and then the magnitude, so how many folks could benefit from this project. You can read more about this within the tax increment investment policy that's on the website, but from here I'm going to hand it over to Hannah to talk through the council action items.
Okay, so I think we can go to the next slide. So just wanted to do a quick recap of what's already come to council for approval. In 2024, August of 2024, approval was given for an election ballot question to authorize debt of $570 million for DDDA projects. Then in November of 2024, authorization was given to create a capital fund to handle those project funds. Then in December of 2024, the amended boundaries of the DDDA came through and the plan of development as well, the amended and restated. Then in this year in February, the second amended and restated DDDA plan of development co-op agreement and tax increment policy, investment policy and program came through. So today we are asking for your consideration and approval of two actions. First one being a proposed ordinance authorizing a loan and a revolving line of credit between the city and PNC Bank. This would be authorized to give the prepayment authority to pay off the 2017 loan agreement and to finance the development projects authorized under the plan of development, co-op agreement, and tax increment policy, investment policy and program. This is that debt authorization that was given by voters in November of 2024 with that 77% of support. The second action we are requesting your consideration and approval on is an action that will be that is being brought forward by our BMO team and establishes a DDDA special revenue fund for those operational and administrative costs. So after these two actions, you should expect to start seeing a couple other actions related to the DDDA. First, the Board of Directors appointments, which will be facilitated by Esther Lee Leach and the Mayor's Office of Boards and Commissions, and then those initial projects and associated property inclusions. Okay, I have a lot to tell you on this slide, so I am going to reference my notes just to make sure I don't miss anything. So this slide shows the two financing tools that are included in the DDDA issuance under the 2024 authorization, a $160 million fixed rate loan and a $50 million revolving line of credit. Together, they provide a flexible structure that supports redevelopment priorities while preserving long-term debt capacity and managing risk. The fixed rate loan offers stable, predictable annual payments through 2038, while the line of credit serves as a short-term funding mechanism that can be tailored to project timing. The sole source of repayment for both of these components is property tax and sales tax TIF revenues generated within the existing DDDA boundaries. Only TIF revenues are pledged. The city is not obligated to use any non-TIF funds for repayment. The TIF base is very stable. So for example, in the first quarter of 2025, sales TIF revenue grew by 1.6% compared to the same quarter in 2024. Current TIF revenue is projected at approximately $40 million annually, and that is based only on the current areas, so Denver Union Station and Market Station, with projected growth up to $43 million by 2038. And keep in mind, these projections are conservative. They do not include any TIF revenue from the newly expanded DDDA investment area, meaning there's upside potential to even increase those projected revenues. So this financing will be a direct placement with PNC, who was selected via competitive bid process. Both financing components are to be issued on a taxable basis to provide maximum flexibility on how those proceeds can be used across a variety of projects. The fixed rate loan has an indicative rate that was provided with the RFP response of 4.83%. That rate will be locked in if we move forward after the ordinance is published. The estimated annual payment on the fixed rate loan is $16.9 million, and it matures in 2038, which is aligned to the DDDA's statutory term. There is a 1.25 times debt service reserve fund ratio required for the fixed rate loan. So essentially, if the ratio is projected to fall below the below that amount, a reserve will be created using the TIF to restore that coverage back to 1.25%. So this is a risk mitigation and not a default trigger. Then depending on how and when that line of credit is drawn, the TIF revenue would need to decline by 35 to 50% for the debt service coverage ratio to fall below one times coverage, meaning that we would have a shortfall in payment, and there's substantial cushion before that would happen. The second piece of this is the revolving line of credit. This was designed as an optional short-term financing tool for eligible projects that need upfront capital. It has a variable rate that is pegged to the 1 month SOFR plus 40 bips or 0.4%. It expires December 31st of 2025 with the option to renew annually for up to 5 years. This does not count against the $570 million voter-approved debt cap, so long as it is repaid within the current the same fiscal year. The repayment sources for this line of credit include excess TIF revenues, reimbursements from short-term projects, and then loan proceeds if necessary. If a year-end repayment isn't possible, the city can convert the rolling line of credit balance to a long-term obligation amortized through 2038. This would count towards the 70 $570 million authorization at that point, but it provides an important contingency option in the event that we are not able to repay within the same fiscal year. Department of Finance will continue to monitor these TIF revenues monthly to ensure that draw amounts remain prudent and repayment plans are in place ahead of time. And this structure overall is designed to balance flexibility with responsibility, support critical redevelopment projects, and preserve capacity for future investments. You can go to the next slide. So the timing on this is if you guys consider and approve to move this forward, we would be at Mayor Council on July 1st, and then first reading on July 14th, second reading on July 21st, and then close on August 7th. So pretty quick timeline, but if you guys have any questions, we will open it up to you guys now.
Fantastic. Thank you. Council President Sandoval, you sit on the DDDA board. Do you have anything you want to say before we go to questions?
I do. Just want to say thank you to the staff who supports us. And I was just telling Donna that I've learned so much through this process, more than you all would know. And they do such a good job. And really want to just thank you all. The plan of development was really co-created with all of you. And as these projects are coming through the queue, I can see that the work that we did at City Council is going to play out to have a better outcome in our downtown Denver. As they mentioned, I think once this bill goes through, it's going to get much more active. You're going to see things coming through much more often. And so if you have questions, I'll do my best to be the ambassador from that board on there. And we are expanding the board. And when I've met with Bill Mosier in the mayor's office, who is the point of contact for the DDA, and talked about how diversity is really important for me on that board. I'm the only woman and only person of color on the board. And so that has been something for me that has been really important as we think about the who the mayor is going to recommend and who we approve. And I've learned a lot there. A lot of them have an extensive development background, major. And so sometimes I'm sitting in meetings and I have to like Google, what is this? I don't know what that means. So I'm learning a lot. And but just be prepared, because once this comes through, we're going to see projects. And remember, as the projects come through, we'll have to include them into the right of way. So you'll see separate ordinances if we think we want to approve a project or not, because they'll have to be the inclusion to the right of way will happen. And then after a week or two later, they would come as the contract. And I think that for the start, a lot of them might be things that you'll all see, and ones that don't get approved by City Council that are under the 500. If you have questions, I'm happy to answer, because some of them won't be, but they'll be really good economic kickstarters for downtown Denver, which is really important for me. So that's it. And just want to say thank you, Donna, that you all have done such a great job. It's a really active board right now. There's only five of us, so if one of us misses, it's really small. I'm accustomed to being on a board with all of you, you know, and my other boards that I sit on, but if two people are gone, we barely have quorum. So that will be something else that we're looking at as part of the DDA board is, do we need, because we have authorization to have up to how many? I can't remember.
Up to 11.
So as you know, we will have to have that conversation as a board. Do we need more people than five having oversight over $570 million to activate our downtown Denver? Yeah. So thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you. I don't see any questions. Oh, Councilmember Flynn, go ahead.
All right. Since you're having one. Tell us, how is the $160 million, the estimated amount, how is that sized? Does that have to do with what is currently available? Because we certainly couldn't borrow all $570 million. So how are we sizing this? What goes into that?
That's a great question. So I can give a little bit, and then Donna can fill in too. From our perspective, it's really to provide that flexibility for down the road. So this gives a little chunk to work with at the beginning, but it's not a first-come, first-served basis. And so this allows us to come back and have another bite at the apple for those projects that come in and are really good to use these funds in the future. So we'll be able to do a future tranche if the revenues support that debt.
Okay, $160 million estimated amount, which will be finalized but right before the close, I imagine, mm-hmm. is based on what we see as the current capacity of the TIF area?
Provide some light there.
The TIF revenues are projected through 2038 to be approximately $570 million. So this $160 million is just a preservation of that significant amount of that debt authorization amount. This program came about pretty quickly, and we didn't have the opportunity to ready the market for projects to quickly submit an application. So we want to give... That is true. Yes, good point. So we want to give those projects a fair chance at getting their projects in a position ready to apply for funding and get their projects rolling.
Do you have a thought or an estimate of how, what is the range by which the $160 million could change after we pass the ordinance before closing? It moves within a range of $160 million plus or minus what?
TIF regeneration, is that the
$160 million estimated amount?
The loan is locked in at $160 million. That amount would not go up. It's the locked-in rate that could potentially go up because it would be locked to market rate after publishing the ordinance. So that $160 million par will not change.
Okay. It was just confusing because in the chart it has an asterisk by estimated amount, which says to be finalized after the ordinance is published. So that's not changing.
No.
Okay. Take that asterisk out of there.
Will do. Thank you very much for the notes.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Councilmember Watson.
Quick follow-up on Council, and first and foremost, thank you so much for the several briefings and really the great work, and thank you, Council President, for leading a very complex process to the beginning. I just want to clarify, as far as the TIF forecast, it's about $40 million we're forecasting just from the designated areas, that year over year to start. Just the not the current designated area, but the original designated, not even the larger footprint. Is that correct?
That is correct. So that is only based off of the Union Station and Market Station area. And so there's no additional TIF included in those estimates at this point.
I think that's awesome. At least based on kind of what the $160 million that we will have in the loan debt when we're looking at just currently Union Station and that smaller boundary, and we're already forecasting $40 million. I think that puts us in a secure space. I have a question on the trigger for the variable revolving line of credit. Can you talk through again, what would that trigger be to roll that into? What are the circumstances that need to occur in order for us to leverage that line of credit outside of simply as a line of credit to maybe support the larger financial infrastructure of the projects? Mm-hmm.
So ideally right now, it's set up as a mechanism to remain short-term and address those kind of upfront costs. So ideally, we would keep it as such to make sure that we're preserving that $570 million of capacity. Now, if, as you know, a multi-fiscal year obligation is not allowed. So this is technically right now short term. And so in the event we couldn't pay within the same fiscal year, that would be the trigger to convert to that long-term facility.
And would that go to a fixed rate or would that remain variable if that trigger occurs?
Great question. It would be on parity with the loan. So it would be a fixed rate. Yep.
Can you describe for all of us SOFR plus 40 BPSs? Sounds exciting, but would love for you maybe to share what that actually means as far as the calculation of the financing of the million that was secured.
Yes, that's a great question. So the SOFR rate that we're looking at is going to be something that's published monthly. And so if we just looked up, you know, say it was 4.81% today, we would take that 4.81% and then add 0.4%. Oh. And so that would be our rate that we would be charged at that point in time. And then the next month when it recalculates, then it would be updated and that would be how the interest fluctuates.
Okay. Thank you so much. And one final comment. Council President Sandoval, thank you so much for your leadership. I think your point, and you were being a little subtle about the size of the board and the equity, the focus of who are the leaders at the table. I think absolutely, I know the intent is to expand. I think really, I know in 5 points in our communities, which is outside of the DDDA boundary, I think we want to make sure that the voices of folks who can speak to community of color, showing the connectivity between downtown and Ballpark and 5 points, that those voices are heard, and I look forward participating in how we would expand that board and have folks with that voice, may not be a developer, but really someone that is entrenched or rooted within community. But thank you all so much for your good work on this so far. Thank you, Committee Chair.
Great, thank you. Seeing no other questions, I just have one. Really appreciate the additional explanation for the variable rate line of credit. As you know, in my briefing, was very concerned about that. So I just want to back it up to 30,000 foot level for those watching at home. Are we obligating the general fund to repay that credit card debt if we can't pay it out of the TIF funds?
You're not.
Perfect. That was all I needed to know. Great. Thank you very much. So we're going to move these in a block, and I will need a motion and a second from voting members. All right. Moved by Council President Sandoval, second by Council Member Watson. Do we need a roll call vote? I don't think so. Doesn't seem like it. Great. Thumbs up from everybody. Thank you so much. We'll see you on the floor. Okay. We are going to transition to our second item. Council Members Watson and Flynn, I believe you guys are going to take it away on this one. And we've got public comment for this. We, I believe, have two people signed up for public comment, both online. So after the presentation, we will go ahead to public comment, and then we'll go to council member questions. I don't see it.
He's going to go.
All right, I think we're ready. Take it away.
Well, good morning, colleagues. Good morning, committee chair. I'm honored to be the co-sponsor of what we're calling Voter Choices Majority, Voter Voices Majority Choices. It's a lot of good words, but I think it speaks to the heart and soul of why we're putting forward this this initiative, and we're asking for your support to move this out of committee. I want to thank my co-sponsor, Councilmember Flynn, and our other co-sponsors, Councilmembers Alvidres, Councilmember Gilmore, Councilwoman Sawyer, for co-sponsoring this bill. We think this is a common sense ask for a change to the ways in which we elect our council members at large. It will put us into consistency with how all municipal elections occur within the city and county of Denver. And I got to share, I ran on three election reform type issues. I ran on a changing of the FEF, slight changes to it that I co-sponsored with Council Member Sawyer. I also ran on ranked choice voting, which is another election year, election reform request, and that I will be co-sponsoring with Council Member Parity. And I ran on this as well because I believe that all three are very small, slight changes to the way we elect our city council members and folks across the municipal candidates, but it provides consistency and it provides the opportunity for us to lead. So what are we proposing in this, what I believe, a very simple bill? We are proposing to have separate ballots for at-large seats. Two at-large members elected on separate ballots, at-large A and at large B, instead of a single vote for two on one ballot. Each still represents the entire city as they do now. There'll be no change as to what the at-large council members would support. They will still support the full city and county of Denver, which is absolutely necessary, but they will be on two separate ballots.
It ensures majority winners as required of all other Denver city officials. All other citywide officials running in our municipal races also run for a 50+1% vote. This will bring that level of consistency, and our fellow historian, Councilmember Flynn, will speak to the history of why that is important and the initial thoughts of the creation of the seats and why this brings it into continuity with that initial thought. It eliminates what is referred to as a single-shot voting, increasing total vote and bringing more voters' voices into our democracy. This will address two concerns around our current voting process. Right now, we have no requirement for at-large winners to achieve the majority. We've had one council member at large, I believe Council Member Ortega, that received the majority, and Councilmember Flynn, once again, will share a little bit of the history of this. This was not the original intent of the voter-approved plan. The voter-approved plan was for two elections, a primary and a general election. But one part of this was tossed out by the state Supreme Court in 1971, which was the primary. This proposal restores the original intent and aligns at-large with all other Denver elected officials by achieving greater than 50% of the vote. Single ballot with two votes prompts many voters to leave their second election blank. Data from voting records that we'll share within this presentation clearly indicates significant amount of additional undervoting due to single-shot voting strategy. Majority choices require at-large winners to win more than 50% of the vote. It's quite simple. Once again, brings us in par with everything that we do right now for every other seat, for every municipal race. And I think it will be an easier way for folks who are electing folks within our municipal races in 2027 to understand that every candidate is elected the same way. This amendment ensures winners will receive majority support. A little bit of background, in nine elections since 1991, average first place percentage was 32.77%. Average second place percentage was 24.41% for at-large races, for the two races that we now elect based on plurality. This aligns at-large voting method with all other elected city officials, which was the original intent when the at-large seats were established in 1971. And ensures use of same system for all municipal offices.
So I'm going to take the next couple slides. We call it voter voices equal majority choices because the data show pretty clearly that the vote for two on a single ballot has resulted in a lot of blanks left on people's ballots. And based on some of the questions that came up at budget and policy, I dug a little deeper into it. And it's actually quite remarkable. In the last three elections, undervoting in the at-large races, undervoting means a blank left on the ballot, was three and a half times the rate of undervoting in contested district races. So I had two opponents. I don't know who else had.
I had two opponents.
You had two, and Councilwoman Lewis. Councilwoman Gilmore was unopposed. But in those contested races, in those districts, the voters, three and a half times the rate, left their at-large choice blank, their first or their second or both. In the auditor's race, because that came up the last time, the undervoting in at-large in the last three elections was 84% higher than undervoting in the auditor race, which is not the highest profile race in the city. And speaking of not the highest profile race in the city, clerk and recorder, 61% higher rate of undervoting in the clerk and recorder race than at large. But here was what to me was the most interesting. In the nine district races that were uncontested over the last three elections, there were three seats where the incumbents ran without opposition. So nine of them over the last three elections. Even then, in an uncontested race, the at-large undervoting was 25% higher. That is a significant difference, and it's clear evidence of people deciding to vote only for one for one reason or another. Our system, I just want to underline this last point, which is why I underlined it. The system should not incentivize voters to not vote, and that's what we're doing. We went over most of this at the budget and policy, but just to reiterate, of the 100 largest cities in America, 33 of them have at-large members. Some have all at-large. Of those 33 cities, 76% of them use a two-round election system. That's what Denver was meant to have when the at-large seats were established for the 1971 election. Two charter amendments were passed, one of which established 11 districts instead of 9 and added 2 at-large. The other amendment, which was later struck down by the Supreme Court of Colorado, had partisan elections. We were to change from nonpartisan to partisan elections. And there would have been caucuses at the district level and the city level, precinct caucuses, Democrats and Republicans, nominating to a county assembly and a district assembly to put people on a primary ballot. And then the winners of those primaries would face one another in the general election in June. And that's how the at-large were supposed to be elected, along with everyone else. The Supreme Court invalidated that about a month before that was all to start. We ended up with no way to actually elect the at-large, so we defaulted to the state guidelines, which said whoever gets the most votes wins, no matter how many that is. So we have reached out to, several folks who sat in the at-large seats, and we have endorsements of this from former at-large councilman Doug Linkhart. You can read his testimony there. I won't read it to you. And also to Councilwoman Debbie Ortega, who served not only at-large, but she served 4 terms in a district seat in the 80s and the 90s. It was termed out in 2003, and as you all know, came back and served 3 terms at-large. And the point that she makes, and I'm going to bring this forward, the current at-large system for electing, at-large members has resulted in the last 56 years, only 3 persons of color being in those seats. I do want to point out that our runoff system for in a citywide election for mayor, in 7 of the elections that had mayoral runoffs, where there was a candidate of color running for mayor, 6 of those 7 times, this city elected the person of color as mayor. In eight elections, and 6 of them were contested with runoffs. So the runoff system has performed really well in ensuring that minority voices and minority candidates are being heard. And with that, we have the timeline. We're hoping to get your approval to take this to the floor. And with that, we'll take questions.
Well, before we go to questions, I wanted to see if Councilmember Gilmore, and I know Councilmember Sawyer, you're leading the committee, but I wanted to leave space for the other sponsors if they wanted to add any thoughts before we go to questions.
I'm good. Thank you.
I think you guys did a fantastic job of providing all of the information. Before we go to questions, we do have public comment.
Yes.
So wanted to make sure we had an opportunity. Both of our public commenters are online. I wanted to see if there's anyone in the room who is interested in public comment. It doesn't look like there is. So we will go online for public comment. For those watching at home, public commenters in committee have 2 minutes to speak. Will you be timing them or will I be timing them? Okay, great. And will there be a clock on the?
I believe so.
Yes.
Okay. Perfect. All right, let's go to our first public commenter.
Bless you.
Jana Everett.
Thank you, Council. I'm a member of Together Colorado's Denver organizing chapter, and I just want to say that I oppose Council Members Flynn and Watson's proposal to separate the 2 at-large council seats into separate races. I do agree with them that the current system leads to wasted votes, and it would be better for the winners of the at-large contests to garner a majority of votes. But a better solution is Councilmember Parody's proposal to implement ranked choice voting for all city positions. Voters rank candidates by preference, and if no candidate receives a majority of first choice votes, the last place candidate is eliminated, and those voters' second choice votes are counted until someone achieves a majority. This would get rid of the current costly runoff system and ensure that all council members are elected by a majority of Denver voters. Thank you.
Thanks.
Great. Thank you. Our next speaker is Marilyn Ackerman.
Good morning. Thank you. My name is Marilyn Ackerman, and I'm in Councilwoman Lewis District 8 and Sarah Parody and Serena Gonzalez Gutierrez. Oops. It's still not unmuted? Okay.
No, we can hear you. You're fine.
Okay.
You're
also good. Represent me, and I am a member also of Together Colorado. I guess we're the only ones testifying here today. I want to just address this bill, and I don't see this as a problem we need to solve. I'm baffled that council members Flynn, Watson, Sawyer, Gilmore, and Alvidrez at the prior meeting wanted to focus on this when our federal government is talking about massive cuts to Medicaid, Medicare, deporting thousands of our immigrant friends and neighbors. Housing problems are all we can think about right now. Rent, utility, groceries are rising. This seems like a huge waste of time to fix something that I think is not broken. It's hard enough to get people to run for office. I think the system will inhibit, not help, women and people of color to run for at-large positions. You may withdraw if you don't think you have a chance on that particular slot. I don't think this will cure the drop-off voting. You can't force people to vote down the ballot. I listened to the committee briefing, as I said, and I don't agree that all of, I mean, maybe your voters are educated on your council positions, but it's not true for ones who vote for at-large council. The majority of my educated friends had no idea who their council, even district council person was or at-large person was at the time of the election. Now, our committee members on Together Colorado know, but we have to be educated on who's running. And that, I think, counts for the drop-off on the down-ballot voting. In my unofficial research, Councilman Flynn, I'm not an official researcher. But how will you decide on slot A and B? The Harry Potter sorting hat? As City Clerk and Recorder Lopez stated, they don't want to look like a politicized office by deciding who gets on what slot. It would have to be random. And the most well-known or best bankrolled candidates could end up on slot A, and the lesser.
Thank you.
On slot
That's
B.
your time.
Okay.
Great. Appreciate it.
Can I respond to that?
Sure. Why don't you go ahead? Okay.
The proposal isn't for randomly putting people who want to run for at large on A or B. The intent is that candidates themselves will choose: I will run for seat A, or I will run for seat B. It's totally up to the candidates, as all districts are. When I ran in 2011, actually, I was considering running, and I thought of running at large or in the district. But I ended up getting another job that I had to put myself into, and I just didn't run. But we all have those choices. Would I run in District 2 or would I run at large? I faced that in 2015 as well. So it's no different for this. It's not really that complicated at all in response to Marilyn. In response to Gina, I would say that ranked choice voting very rarely results in a majority winner because of exhausted ballots. It disenfranchises people who do not select any of the remaining candidates. Their ballots left out of the count and left out of the denominator, which very frequently prevents 50% plus one.
And I was going to share on the point from Marilyn, and I hear you, Marilyn, and I appreciate the leadership of Together Colorado. There are plenty of opportunities that we are leading on as city council members, plenty of bills that come through us every day, every week that we're leading on. And I think the opportunity for us as elected officials is to be able to deliver on all of the above. All of my energy is not just focused on this. I have about five other bills and a new one that I'm beginning. And so I think we have a staff of folks, and we have complete ability to lead on many things. And so we're not leaving. Housing is one of my top priorities. I'm still going to continue fighting, and I've passed, in collaboration with city council members, great housing bills.
Councilwoman Watson, we have
people in the queue for questions. So
I wanted to hit on, I'm the co-sponsor for ranked choice voting, and I'm the primary co-sponsor for a reason. I believe that all of my election reform bills support each other. I do not see ranked choice voting competing with this bill. I don't agree with my co-sponsor on this one, but I believe they both work with each other. And I look forward to receiving questions from council members.
Great. Councilmember Gonzalez Gutierrez, let's start with you.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have just a few questions and statements. So going back to when you were in budget policy, I still am a little bit confused because I think the reason for, the question around how this eliminates the undervote. So how does having that large seats on separate questions eliminate the undervote? And is there research and evidence supporting the reasons that you've cited, which were confusion, voter confusion, single shot voting, and people not just caring?
Yes, certainly. And the Q&A that we put out addresses this. The data clearly show a substantial, statistically significant difference in undervoting in the at-large race because that can only be attributed to single shot. Councilwoman Parody, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but on Channel 9, you pointed out that your husband voted only for you. Debbie Ortega told me that people who voted when she was running at-large, that she found out some of her supporters were telling folks, vote only for me, don't use your second vote. So we know that this can eliminate that reason. It won't eliminate all undervoting because there's always undervoting.
But that's what the document says. It said it will completely eliminate the undervoting.
It eliminates single shot voting. Yes, it eliminates single shot voting.
I still question whether or not that's true because people can still choose to vote for only one candidate in A or B because if they don't like anybody in the seat A or seat B, then they can just vote for seat A. Wouldn't that be correct?
Councilmember Watson, please let Councilmember Gonzalez Gutierrez finish before responding. Yeah.
I thought you were finishing.
No, I was finishing up. I just said that could lead still to single shot voting, where if somebody, if they don't like anybody in seat B, and they're only going to vote for somebody in seat A.
That's not single shot voting.
Yes.
Single shot voting is when you can vote for two, and you choose only to vote for one.
So then it would lead to undervotes for seat B.
You could still have undervoting because people, there's undervoting for mayor, there's undervoting for president.
Correct.
Right.
The next question I have is, was there any research done on best practices to increase voter participation in at-large races? Are there any findings for the causes of undervotes specifically in Denver elections or any findings of unintended consequences regarding this proposed policy?
Not on increasing voter education or awareness. That's up to campaigns to do that. Unintended consequences, we've come across a few, and there's some trade-offs, of course. Some of you have mentioned that it might be possible that the two people you really want at large are running for one seat, and you can only vote for one of them. And so that's a genuine consequence as well. So
voter participation, though, wouldn't that be also like the clerk and recorder? Like, that's why we have so many more ballot boxes. Yeah. It's not just the campaigns.
Oh, yes. Correct.
And may I interject? And I was going to say, I think the great opportunity with this is that right now we know how majority vote elections occur. And I'll say in District 9, speaking to drop-off votes, there are folks who may have simply voted just for me and not for the other two candidates. That's not single shot because there's not two options. But in every election that we have where there is an opportunity for a majority vote, there are folks who only vote for one person. This is not will not solve for the undervoting of telling folks not to, encouraging folks to vote for everyone on the ballot. What this does, it removes the inconsistency of how our candidates are elected, moving at large to a majority vote, just like everyone else. And all of the issues that deal with our elections as stand aren't going to be solved by this because we're not solving for undervotes for elections for individual candidates.
That has been the reason that Councilman Flynn has stated to me from the beginning, when I first, when we first had a conversation, you said my biggest concern is the undervotes.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it you are claiming that it is solving
issues for undervotes. We believe from the evidence, and we've provided information, Councilmember Gonzalez-Gutierrez, that the undervotes within the at-large races are out of skew from every other race. I'm saying the reason why I started writing this bill, and I did this in separate from Councilmember Flynn, was the 50% plus one. Mm-hmm. I believe majority votes are important. That's why we listed these two pieces. I think Councilmember Flynn's piece that I support strongly, that this will help reduce undervote for at-large races, because every other race has 50% plus one, has shorter, smaller undervotes. I also believe moving it to 50% plus one, a majority vote, brings it into consistency with all other elections, and it goes back to the original rationale for why the at-large was created.
So, I mean, I guess the question around, like, research into any of the questions that I asked, I will send it to you as well in email form so that you have it written. But from what I, checked in with our policy analyst to find out if any of this had been looked into, it sounds like maybe they hadn't looked into it. However, if you have documented any research of this, not just, like, the anecdotes of what we've heard of what has happened in previous races, but actual, like, research and evidence, I would love to see that. My last question, and then I have one last final comment, is around voting rights organizations. So aside from sending the proposal to the list of organizations that you listed in the Q&A document that you provided to us, so thank you so much for providing that. I'm curious what kinds of conversations have taken place or stakeholding has taken place with some of these organizations, and what was the outcome of those conversations?
We've done several outreaches to all those folks. We've had a presentation at the League of Women Voters Alternate Voting Methods Task Force, and the others have, we've reached out several times and we have not heard back yet.
Have you reached out to schedule meetings with them to talk about the proposal?
Yeah, we have. And I'll also add, Councilmember Gonzalez-Gutierrez, I think your point is a valid point. We have a list in our Q&A of all of the voter outreach organizations that we've reached out to and that we're receiving ongoing communications with. Unlike the other ballot initiative proposal that I'm supporting, this has not been a five-year statewide process that has built up a whole host of folks that has millions of dollars behind it. This is an idea that 4 months ago that I spoke with the clerk and recorder's office to see, is this a viable option? Does this meet the requirements for the rule of law? Our focus is to make sure that we engage. We've had one town hall. We have another one tonight. I encourage you to come to that, where all of these organizations are invited to attend. We intend to continue having these discussions with them, but we have not had sought sponsorship like the other election reform piece that has been going on for years, that has lots of money behind it. We are a bootstrap focused on making sure we're building consistency in the way we elect the at-large council members.
I hear that. I think, though, there is a space to reach out to these organizations and say, hey, we're going to hold a couple meetings. You're welcome to come and join so that we can talk about this. I've done
it
for the last 6 years as a legislator, knowing that usually those organizations will show up, right? When they know that this is something that impacts their membership and the community that they serve. So I would ask that occur and that the feedback and the outcomes from that that is provided. The last thing I'll just say is, with regard to diversity, since 1975, of the 11 at-large members elected, 7 of them have been women. 3 have been people of color, with 2 of them being women of color. And so I just wanted to address that point of data. During the last presentation, there was also a correlation made between our elections and election integrity concerns. I struggle to understand how these two things are related, as our clerk and recorder and elections teams have the highest standards for how our Denver elections are administered. This is not about election integrity, so I want to make sure we're not putting like this in relation to that. It was stated by one of the sponsors. Our elections are fair, safe, and accessible. We cannot control for how people decide to fill out their ballots. It is their choice of that person, and I do not see how this will necessarily fix the perceived issue. I do think that there are other ways that we could discuss, such as what our clerk and recorder mentioned, such as possibility of staggering our city council elections. However, I know I've mentioned that to one of the sponsors, and I was told that this would create lower turnout. Again, I would love to see the data behind that, that site. And I would want to see how we come to that conclusion. So with that said, you know, I am not in support of this moving forward. I would like to see more of this work done, more of the stakeholding done, more conversations around whether or not this is the appropriate fix for the issue, because I hear the concern around majority vote, but I don't know that this is necessarily the fix for that issue. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you. Councilmember Gilmore.
Madam Chair, I wanted to weigh in as one of the co-sponsors on this because, you know, serving on Denver City Council coming up on 10 years, in a perfect world, I think we would expect that the at-large positions are super supportive and there to support the district communities, the district council members. I can't say that that's been my experience at all. If anything, I think a really excellent example of that is the recent conversation about Peña Boulevard. That conversation for certain members did not align in any way, shape, or form with the people that I was elected to represent by 50% plus one in District 11. I've ran three times. My vote on that dais is backed by 50% plus one of the residents in my district. If we want to really want to start talking about equity and fairness, 50% is the baseline. It's the base. And I want to be able to assure my residents that they have the ear, the relationship, the support of the at-large offices. And I don't know how we assure that without requiring the candidates to garner and to earn. It is never given. Every vote is earned, and it's hard fought for, and it needs to be earned. And that's why I'm supporting this, because it makes me think, well, maybe there should be a percentage process of, do the votes, one vote equal one person, or is it truly a majority who put you in that seat? And the numbers are there. And so, you know, slot A or slot B, it is campaign strategy. It is strategy. Honestly, I'd rather be on slot B. Because you know what? You don't know who you're gonna get, but I will make it work. When you go in to see where you're gonna be ranked on the list, when you run against five people on an open seat and you don't know where you're gonna be, everybody wants to be ranked one, but you better have a good enough campaign strategy or the drive and the fire to serve in a democracy that you are majority voted in to do this work. And so I think it's important from those pieces, especially when people are not feeling represented in the cost of living in our city, food scarcity, violence, the whole list. They want to see people who have the backing of the neighborhood making these decisions. And so that is why I am supporting this. Because why would I want to say, oh, yeah, the next person who runs for my seat, 33% is going to be good. That's going to be great. You just get 33% and you're going to represent District 11. We would have an outcry from our constituents. And so I don't know why we're not embracing that this is an opportunity to garner more votes and get more involvement. And yeah, the clerk is working hard on it, but it's up to all of us and it's up to the candidates. Quite honestly, to do the work and to build the community relationships so that you can garner that 50+1 percentage. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great, thank you. Council President Sandoval.
Thank you. So I've been vacillating back and forth on this. And I understand, Councilman Gilmore, your sentiment. I was a council aide when I-70 was going through Global Leary and Swansea. And it was single-handedly one of the hardest times because the councilwoman I was working for was getting direct feedback about rerouting the highway to 270 and not putting that through, and pretty much taking out an old bridge. But it felt like I'll never forget Councilwoman Montero coming to me and saying she felt like she was on an island, and that she felt very isolated, and that she did not feel like she had the support of the two at large, and that she had really just the support of the people who were working in her office, because she was fighting for Global Leary and Swansea to make sure that they had what would be in the record of decision. And it was really hard. I learned a lot, so I can understand where you're coming from of feeling that way when you're not feeling very supported by some of the people you work with. And at the same time, with this proposal, I've never not voted for two people. And I think I've told you that. I didn't even know that was a way to campaign. I grew up around the corner from Debbie Ortega. I never heard anyone say anything about this. And right now, as somebody who's the president of city council and leading, this is one of my most diverse councils that I've seen in my career of being at city council since starting in 2012. When I started with Councilwoman Montero, there was not a majority of people of color. There were women, but it was hard pressed for her to understand, convey to those colleagues at the time of what was happening in the communities of Global Leary and Swansea and the rapid regentrification of Five Points that we now don't even hardly call Five Points. We call it Rhino. We call it after an art district. And so for me, I just don't understand. I understand that there needs to be changes somewhat in our voting. But when I was chairing the redistricting process, I think that there was a proposal at that time to change, and I just didn't feel like there was enough outreach. I created a special budget and policy committee so that this could come to budget and policy, because you hadn't reached out to me really early on. I listened to Councilwoman Gilmore. I think you told me in December or January, hey, have a legislative tracker so that we can understand what bills are coming through so we can be more organized. I immediately implemented that with central staff, and I did it a little bit different. I said, I don't want to be the keeper of the legislative tracker because I think you all should have autonomy from me. I don't want to be like, hey, so I worked with Luke and Anshul and said, why don't you be the keeper of the legislative tracker so that you can understand what's happening. You all run committees. And even with that, they split up and met with council members. No one came to me and said, hey, I have this proposal. I want to do outreach. I want to do this. So with that being said, I'm just going to be a no in committee today. I've told Councilwoman Parody, I know I'm switching gears, if she were to bring the ranked choice voting, I'm going to be a no. And I feel like it's just, I'm going to be a no if it makes it out of committee on the floor. And I just need to be very clear with my vote. And I also just want to say, when it comes to big changes like this, when I was leading redistricting, I think I met with Councilwoman Gilmore a year and a half before it was even supposed to come. I brought her my plan. I said, this is what I have to do. This is in the time of COVID. Here's strategically how I'm going to have different outreach throughout the entire city. I thought about high schools. I had a group of people helping me. I met with her often because as president, she was also leading the executive director's office, so I knew she had tons on her plate. And I kept meeting with her and said, here's my proposal, so that when this came to city council, it didn't feel like it was only two and done. And so I just wish you all would have done that. I wish you all would have just come to us in way earlier. And this doesn't have to be a done deal. We have an election in next year, and we have an election after that, and we have an election every year. And so right now, currently how I feel, knowing my council district, when I'm out having drinks with my friends, I try not to talk about city work. They're just not even aware of this. I have, they're like literally no one in Northwest Denver knows about this. And we had one of the at-large for a really long time from Northwest Denver. I've even asked people who are really politically involved, hey, have you heard about this? And they just haven't. And so I wanna just make sure that there's enough robust outreach for this proposal to come. So this time I'm gonna vote no. If you bring it back around next year and there's more outreach and there's more vetting, I'm open to changing my mind. So that's just how I feel right now. And thank you all for the sponsors. I think that you all are attempting to solve for something that you feel. That's your truth. And it's not for me. I can't not say that that's not your truth. Your lived experience as council members is your lived experience, and I just want to honor that. And thank you all for working on something and attempting to try to solve for an undervote. I just see as somebody who's representing this body, I see tons of diversity, and so I just don't feel like I'm trying to solve for any, for, in my lived experience, I just can't support it right now. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great, thank you. So we have 10 minutes left and four council members in the queue, plus me. So we're gonna go to two questions each. Councilmember Parody.
I have a lot of thoughts here. One thing I want to make really clear is, again, I think the diagnosis of the problem keeps shifting. So things I've heard today include that there was allegedly a single-shot voting strategy. The reason I made the joke about my husband is because he's the only single-shot voter. He's my husband. I did not use that strategy. You can go through every campaign email that I sent. I never asked anybody to vote only for me. You could ask my closest campaign supporters, and I believe most of them voted for me and another candidate, because I actually actively encouraged them to do that. Councilmember Gonzalez Gutierrez has said that she did not use that strategy. So the two winners of the at-large races never used such a strategy. Perhaps that's available, perhaps other people would use it. Why on earth are we trying to send a charter change to the ballot to allegedly combat a political strategy that has not been used except maybe during one of Councilmember Ortega's races in the past? If the diagnosis is that all elections in this country somehow have to hit a 50% threshold, that is not true. There are many theories of democracy out there. If you want to dig into all of the theoretical literature in the world, most countries and most jurisdictions actually have moved towards systems of voting that that are plurality systems of voting. European democracies have multiple parties. In America, we've had people for years asking for more space on ballots for things like Green Party candidates and that sort of thing, because people want the ability to express more of a range of preferences. That's also the theory behind ranked choice voting, which I know Councilmember Watson supports along with me. And I will say it again, this current at-large system is closer to a ranked choice flavor than anything else we have, because you are campaigning in a collaborative way to try to be one of people's top two favorite votes. So the idea that there's some magical talismanic thing about an election in which only 30% of the registered voters turn out to begin with, that's who elected us. 30% of the registered voters in the city elected all of us. That is incredibly artificial to begin with. Everybody who ran in a very multivariate race with a lot of candidates, including the mayorals, including the at-large candidates, including some of the districts like District 7, where there were many, many candidates on the ballot, got far less than 50% in the first round. And we have a system that we've had for 55 years since 1970, where we I want to say this because it's responsive to the assertions of the sponsors. We have used the system for 50 years. We have these two seats that are identical seats. That's why we use a plurality system for those seats. Plurality systems are common and valid throughout the world. So I don't understand why they have to be the same as the other seats. Part of the point of these seats is that they are in fact different. And so we get some variety. People are represented by two at-large members plus their district member, and it gives us different ways for voters to express their preferences. Voting for one candidate can also be a valid way to express your preference. So I don't understand the problem, I don't understand the diagnosis, but what I do understand is that this appears to be something that will be funded at the ballot by organizations like Colorado Concern, who are wildly out of step with Denver voters. The politicians they highlight on their website are people like Mike Kaufman, Paul Lundeen, who do not represent Denver. The stakeholding that occurred has occurred in the last couple of weeks. This is not a grassroots thing. It does not have broad community support. It has support from groups that I do not think have Denver voters.
I've got to ask you to stop now.
That's it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Councilmember Lewis.
So I had a question regarding the district representatives, because we definitely represent a geographical area and the at-large members represent the entire city. And so sometimes they might get a different perspective than we may see, that we may see as individuals that are attached to geographical areas. And so as you spoke, Councilmember Gilmore, I'm curious as how you think about that in the context of, like, they may be getting a larger perspective and it may not be isolated in the same way that you may be in terms of your specific district. Mm-hmm.
I think that's an excellent question. I have to not overlook that Montbello and Green Valley Ranch are the two most diverse neighborhoods in the entire city. And I think that they deserve, for many reasons, even more attention and outreach and engagement from individuals in the at-large seats. And let me be clear, I'm not talking personally about the two people who sit in these seats today. I'm talking about the entire...
Really specific to those two seats, though. Like, we have to be honest, Pena, when you mention Pena.
No, I've talked about Pena for 10 years. Pena is not a new issue that just came up with this class of council members. Pena has been an ongoing issue for my entire time in office, because it could have been made a toll road long ago and really restricted access for residents in the far Northeast. And so it was an average of my entire experience. But when I have black and brown families and residents berating me, saying that the elected representatives don't know anything about our neighborhood, don't care about our neighborhood, don't have any creative solutions or options about how we can make it safer to get in and out of our neighborhood, I'm not carrying water for anybody else. I represent myself, and I have to let others who are elected represent themselves. But that is what the people are saying, is they don't feel like their day-to-day concerns are being elevated and carried forward. And if those are the two most diverse neighborhoods in our city, I would be remiss if I didn't say anything about this and let it go by and not get into the mix on it, because they're not feeling like their voices are being heard or there's enough back and forth. It's just a nope, that's it, and go forward without any further conversation. And they've lived that for as long as Denver has been around. So this is an ongoing issue that comes up and rears its head.
Great, thank you. My final question is, how does this solve for that? Any of the sponsors can answer that question.
How does it solve for what?
For what she's outlining.
Well, I think Councilmember Gilmore spoke for herself as to why.
From my perspective.
Yeah.
I have already said it. I'm not going to repeat what I already said.
Yeah, and I'll say once again, I want to be clear. My focus on this bill is that I believe every municipal seat should...
I'm sorry, Angela, because I know we don't have...
I know, but...
I'm sure that you're answering the question that I put on the table, because I only had two.
Councilmember, I appreciate you...
How does it solve for the lack of representation and the lack of engagement? How does this policy solve for that?
Well, Councilmember Lewis, I appreciate your question. My answer to your question is the same as Councilmember Gilmore's. My answer to your question is the same as Councilmember Ortega's. We are seeing, based on the data, that the 50% plus one, all of those races have provided for a more a diverse city council, and the majority of city council members sitting on this, the most diverse city council ever elected, were elected by 50% plus one.
What we are solving for are the two things, and we've described that. And committee chair, I wanted to be clear. Colorado Concern was brought into this discussion. I want to make it very clear.
Hold on.
You're eating into my time.
All right, everybody. No, you're, hold on, please. We have got, yes, we've got, you answered the question. No, Councilmember Wesson.
I answered that
That's
question.
That's enough.
Yeah.
Time out.
Yeah.
We have two council members left to speak. You've answered Councilmember Lewis's question. Correct. We're going to have to go over a little bit. We started 10 minutes late, so that should be okay. We're going to go to Councilmember, Council Pro Tem Romero Campbell now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be real short in my, it's not really a question, it's more of a statement, so I'll keep it brief. I've had some conversation and how we've looked at what's been brought before us in committees is it ready for the floor? And so I'm going to look at it, is this ready for the floor? I think that the five council sponsors have done their work around a proposal to bring to the floor. I think, as you can tell from the conversation that's happening here, I think our entire body deserves the opportunity to weigh in and to vote on it. So I will vote yes today to put it on the floor. It doesn't guarantee that I'll vote for it when it's on the floor. It is a solution. I'm not 100% convinced it's the right solution. I think there is a lot of other solutions that have been offered. The staggering of terms, the you know, additional stakeholdering. There is, you know, a variety of things that can be proposed for an at-large position. I don't know if all of those have been mulled through and thought through and considered as far as like what is best for this body. But that is how I am making my decision today as a member of FinGov, because I think this deserves the space for all, because it's a big issue.
Yeah.
And it involves all of us to be able to bring it to the floor so that everybody gets an opportunity to weigh in and to vote on it. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Great, thank you. Councilmember Cashman.
Thank you. I'm no on the bill as I sit here. I think the undervote has to do with the fact that most of the world has no idea what the at-large representatives do, who they are. It's a real stretch for people to even pay attention to their district representative. I think as a body, this discussion has pointed out the need. I think we owe it to our community to redress that and to do more aggressive education on the at-large position. My other concern is that right now I get to vote for my two, number one and number two choices on the ballot for at-large. I think it's a very real possibility, almost unavoidable, that a bunch of people in this scenario are not going to be able to do that because their two favorite choices will be in one column. My two favorite are going to be, I mean, just look at, take the 13 of us, what are the odds somebody's not going to get the vote for their top two at large? That said, I've made it a policy since I've been on council. I believe the sponsors have done, in their view, their best work to prepare this. Like I said, as I sit here today, I expect to vote against it on the floor. I'll vote in favor of moving it forward so we can have this discussion with all 13 members. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Well, we are over. So I will just say, obviously, we're going to need a roll call vote on this. For those watching at home who might not live this every day, just so you are aware, Denver City Council does not have what is called a quote-unquote kill committee, right? We don't work like the state government does, or I actually don't even know how the federal government does this, but where something can die in committee, council members can bring it directly to the floor if we want to, right? So the threshold for the conversation we're having in committee is, is this ready to be considered by the full body? And this is what Councilmember Romero Campbell had just said, but just want to kind of reiterate it for the public so that you understand the conversation is not, do you support this when you vote yes today in committee, if you vote yes today in committee? The conversation is the language right? Has the research been done? Is this ready to be considered by all 13 members of City Council? Because not all 13 members of City Council are voting members of our Finance and Governance Committee. So I just wanted to say that publicly so that everyone sort of understands the same page of, particularly those watching at home, that there may be people who feel that this is ready to go, as I do, to be considered by the full body, who may vote yes today, but that does not mean that they're voting yes on this bill. It means that they are saying they are, that the work is done and that this is ready to be considered by the full council. So just wanted to make that very clear before we do a roll call vote, because I sometimes read in the press or hear from public members who are watching at home who just don't understand that nuance, because it's very different from the way other governments kind of work. And so I wanted to just make sure that we clarify that, given that this is a pretty contentious topic. So with that, I will need a motion and a second. Moved by Councilmember Watson, seconded by Council Pro Tem Romero Campbell. So we will do a roll call vote.
Councilmember Sawyer?
Aye.
Madam President Pro Tem Romero Campbell?
Aye.
Councilmember Gonzalez Gutierrez?
No.
Councilmember Cashman?
Aye.
Councilmember Lewis?
No.
Madam President Sandoval?
No.
And Councilmember Watson?
Aye.
Four ayes.
Great, thank you very much. So four ayes, it passes. Councilmember Flynn, we're over. Is there something you...
Can I make one comment? Councilwoman Ortega has been watching, and she wanted me to point out that her campaign also did not ask people to do
that. Okay. Thank you. We're not done yet, guys. Do not leave yet. We have consent items that we need to just address for everyone. No one's pulled them off, so they will move through, and now we are adjourned.
All right.